Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Louisiana State University professors Nancy Eisenberg and Andrew Burstein, authors of The Problem of Democracy, The President's Atoms Confront the Cult of Personality. It's a great pleasure to speak with Nancy Eisenberg, the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University. We last talked with her about her New York Times bestseller, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And we're happy to welcome Nancy's husband and co-author, Andrew Burstein, the Charles P. Manship Professor of History at LSU. Their new book is The Problem of Democracy, The President's Atoms Confront the Cult of Personality. Nancy, Andy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is such a great biography of John and John Quincy Adams. I feel like I know them now. So why this subject at this particular time?
Well, as historians, we start working on these projects. It takes years of research. But I think what we wanted to do, we had co-authored a book called Madison and Jefferson.
Right.
And we decided that we wanted to try another dual biography, because one of the advantages of writing on two people is it disrupts the normal focus on one person that, you know, at times in traditional biography leads people to think, well, the author is so attached to the subject that they really can't be objective. In this way, you get to see not only the father and son, and we're the first people to look closely at the father and son relationship. It's a very intimate portrait. But we also felt they were perfect subjects for really trying to understand how democracy was shaped in the early stages of American history. So we get to cross the divide that often hampers historians who only look at John Adams and therefore they only study the early republic, or people who only look at the antebellum period and look at John Quincy Adams. And we can sort of see the evolution of how democracy was shaped in this really important formative period. And the past does inform the present.
Democracy wasn't set in stone from the very beginning. It was evolving over this time period. So we see so much about how it changed. Now, the thing that binds these two together, I think, is that they were resolutely idealistic. And they didn't like the popularity contest aspect of politics. And they felt great disdain for those who did, particularly Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson. So we see those figures in light of that. And Andy, you're the author of The Passions of Andrew Jackson, so you know a lot about this particular character.
Yes, John Quincy Adams referred to the man who he first defeated in the election of 1824 and then lost to in the election of 1828. He referred to Andrew Jackson as a barbarian who could not spell. Jackson was ill-educated. He had a sense of his own grandiosity. And, of course, he was a war hero, which contributed to that. But he was also a man who prized loyalty from his subordinates, and he believed in what he called due subordination. Unlike someone like Eisenhower, who left the army and became a president, Andrew Jackson never lost that imperiousness about him. And he didn't really have a political platform. He didn't have educated opinions, and John Quincy Adams, who went back into Congress in the House of Representatives, a move that no president has made since then, a kind of humbling, but at the same time, he felt that being elected to Congress was more a feather in his cap than being elected president. And so there's something truly unique about the sense of honor, and even though it was a very partisan environment, And just as John Adams and the contest with Thomas Jefferson brought out the worst in the conduct of politics, the son knew the same kind of political animosity and party division. They lived through interesting times.
And they had such long careers in public service, and often not at great reward.
This is one of the reasons we like them.
Yeah.
They have such a wide range of experience. The fact that the, you know, father starts out in the Second Continental Congress, as Andy just mentioned, the son does this unusual move to return to Congress after he's been in the presidency. They played a very important role as diplomats in Europe, both of them. The father, in a sense, was involved in ending the Revolutionary War with the Treaty of Paris. The son was involved in ending the War of 1812, in, you know, hammering out the details in the Treaty of Ghent. So you get to see them commenting from various positions that are connected to the federal government. They're both in Congress. They're in the belly of the beast. And that's one of the things that we want to highlight about them. They often get dismissed because their enemies attack them for being supporters of monarchy. And, in fact, that's not what they believed at all. They were not loyalists. But they are important because they did have a respect for a healthy democracy and where democracy needed to be strong. And in particular, they felt Congress had to be the people's branch. They would be horrified by today's Congress being a millionaire's club.
Mm-hmm.
So they believed, this father also believed in the importance of the town meeting, the importance of local knowledge, the fact that everyone, as John Adams argued, must be trained from infancy in the town meeting so they can learn to debate and argue and express their views to their representative effectively. And then the son takes on the role of defending the right of the petition, which is the most inclusive form of expression from average people to the government. And he even defended the right of petition for slaves to have the right of petition.
Right. Another thing you paint, a wonderful portrait of them as readers and bibliophiles, and books were something that bound them together as well. And you chronicle their reading lives in incredible detail.
They shared an immense library, and they purchased in Europe when they were abroad from 1778 to 1785 together, and that's really when they bonded. They purchased books in English and French and Dutch. They traveled through Spain. John Quincy, at a very young age, was in St. Petersburg, Russia,
mm-hmm.
the time of Catherine the Great. So everywhere they went, they haunted booksellers, and they had books going back to the 17th century. Fortunately, they retained not only their books, but their diaries and letters, and all those Atlantic crossings. Somehow, they preserved just tons of their writings. So it's possible to paint a portrait of them as readers and also as literary figures, because John Quincy Adams, when he was U.S. Senator during Jefferson's presidency, was concurrently the Boylston Professor of Rhetoric at Harvard, publishing
right.
his lectures. And John Adams published his works on government, political theory, and history. And they also had a tremendous love for fiction and some comic fiction, picaresque novels, the kinds of things that expose the varieties of human behavior. And this contributed in a profound way to their understanding of American politics, too. They both, in their diaries, wrote beautiful descriptions of day-to-day events and encounters with their colleagues. But John Adams in particular had an almost novelistic talent in his diary, which ostensibly he was just writing for himself. He wasn't really expecting posterity to read it. But we have all of those things, and it makes it possible for us to paint a very intimate portrait of these two, as well as to highlight the urgency that they felt in describing forms of government and suggesting how best to run a republic.
And who could not love an early reader of Don Quixote? You know what I mean? Yeah. If that's one of your favorite books. And they lived such great love stories as well, both of them, which I think kind of anchored them in the world in a kind of wonderful way.
Yeah, I mean, this book is, again, more focused on the father and son and their relationship, because that has been ignored, and people have written about the relationship between John and Abigail Adams. But Abigail Adams is a pivotal player, because she's always in the thick of things. She sort of is often conveying information from John Adams to John Quincy Adams, and she is on top of everything in terms of her political knowledge, and that's what really sets her apart. She's far ahead of John as far as, you know, as we all know, for advocating for women to have a political voice, where he was very skeptical about that. But she also influenced her son. I think this is one of the interesting things we focus on, is that her views, her very hostile views towards slavery, really made a strong impression on her son, because she really viewed, during the Revolution, she was basically arguing, how can anyone really believe in liberty who's a slave owner? And she was horrified. I mean, this is something we think, well, no one talked about this back in the, you know, the 1770s, but she was horrified by the idea that slave owners were sexually abusing slave women.
And when it comes to John Quincy Adams, he married in 1797 in England. He married for love, Louisa Catherine. And both their marriage and his parents' marriage lasted half a century. This was the moment when John Quincy kind of came into his own. He had been arguing back and forth with his mother, you know, in transatlantic correspondence about when he would be ready to marry, because she wanted to make sure that he was financially comfortable before he made the plunge, took the plunge. And at first he listened to his mother, but eventually he said, look, you're going to have to get, well, I'm paraphrasing, look, you're going to have to get used to it. And when Abigail first met, and it was a few years later, because he was abroad for the entirety of his father's presidency. So in 1801, 1802, when Abigail was first getting to know her daughter-in-law, she thought, oh, this little wisp of a woman, she's sickly, she's not going to last long. And eventually, she warmed up to Louisa Catherine. On the other hand, John Adams fell in love with his daughter-in-law instantly. So it's a great story. Mm-hmm. And Louisa Catherine's diaries have been published now, and we rely on them as well. So it is possible to paint a portrait not only of the father and son relationship, but the broader family network.
And the way their ideals inform those networks, and vice versa, of course. Now, I love that you turn near the end of this book to a piece by Walt Whitman in a New Orleans newspaper published in March 1848. What a find that was.
That was an obscure piece. Walt Whitman, in eulogizing, and we can put air quotes around that word, eulogizing John Quincy Adams just after his death in 1848, it was faint praise at best. He was saying, you know, good riddance to that old generation. American democracy, you know, needs the invigoration of this sort of young pioneering set. And by, instead of associating John Quincy Adams with the founding, with sort of the revolutionary enthusiasm that he imbibed as a young boy who grew up seeing the Battle of Bunker Hill from a prominence on his own property south of Boston, Walt Whitman didn't romance John Quincy Adams as kind of someone who was there at the creation, present at the creation. Rather, Whitman, this is before Leaves of Grass, before he went on to become a celebrated poet, looking askance, looking down upon someone so accomplished as John Quincy Adams. It was an unusual essay, an unusual newspaper piece to find.
Well, it made my heart leap for a minute. Newspaper history in New Orleans is long and complicated, as you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we know that.
It seems to me, at least, that we're experiencing this kind of renewed interest in the Founding Fathers, and that the people are looking back to them. Do you find that?
Yeah, well, we have always elevated certain individuals in the national imagination, and no one so much as the Founding Pantheon. And this is why we dwell so much on the cult of personality or cult of celebrity, as they viewed it. And John Adams, for example, not only had a big beef with Benjamin Franklin, whom he called the old conjurer, but he had a lot to say about George Washington, whom he respected.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that makes looking at John and John Quincy Adams, really refreshing and feels, you know, as if this is relevant for today, is, as I said, they didn't want, they felt democracy, you needed a system of checks and balances. You hear that in the news all the time today. You needed a strong Congress, a Congress that took its responsibilities seriously to reflect the interests of the people, not the interests of the party. And this is one of the tensions we see being played out today. And I think that with the cult of celebrity and the cult of personality, this is so relevant. And I think it's important for people today to realize that this has long been an issue that has informed popular politics. Once you make politics into entertainment, and by the time Andrew Jackson is getting elected, you know, at the polls, they have, you know, clever nicknames and campaign songs and parades, and they handed out food and alcohol at the polling places. Once you make it into entertainment, essentially you are going to put much more value on what is the manufactured traits of the candidate rather than talking about policy or, you know, substantive issues. Jackson was the first candidate to have a full-length campaign biography that was selling him as a personality, because he didn't have a lot of political experience. And John Adams, really, he hones in on the importance of spectatorship, the way in which the powerful, everyone has a desire for fame, and the powerful need an audience.
As Americans, we think we've inherited a valid definition of democracy, and we haven't. The founders didn't give us democracy as a one for the ages. They doubted popular wisdom. They confined voting privileges to landholders. And there is no one so much as John Adams, the first to really worry about the power of celebrity in undermining any chance of democracy succeeding. So the irony then is that it was his son who, in his inaugural address as president in 1825, was the first to label the United States a representative democracy. So that's why the president's Adams are, for us, the barometers for measuring pressure on government then, as now, to institute laws that are fair to the majority of citizens. They had the moral courage not to pander. They asked for moral clarity from government. And they opposed the two-party system as organizations that easily hardened, that divided people, and that dictated against the individual standing up for what he believed.
Of course.
So our book is not prescriptive, but it's informative. It's meant to show how that Jeffersonian vision of exceptionalism, of an expansive nation that at the same time stood for small government, we simplify what the founders thought and what they did, and we lionize them in ways that ignore the conduct of politics, which could be often very cruel. And for the Adamses, make a final statement about this. They both believed that there was a real danger of a privileged, moneyed elite, what we call special interests, rising and sort of ruining this really good idea of a republic.
Right. I mean, they were much more afraid of what they referred to as oligarchy, which is really a powerful aristocracy. And when they talked about the power of celebrity, they watched how aristocrats maintained their power through performance in Europe and in other places. And this is the danger, because by the time you get to John Quincy Adams, he realizes with all the hoopla, the entertainment that's going on around campaigning, and this is one of the problems. We know politicians are often seen as, this is how Plato and Socrates referred to them, as chefs feeding people's worst appetites,
right,
as opposed to being statesmen, which they said had to be like doctors who gave you the harsh medicine that you didn't want to hear. He realized that where is power lodged? And behind what he saw, the smokescreen of democracy that was emerging, was a very powerful alliance between land speculators and slaveholders who wanted Western expansion. Slaveholders wanted slavery to expand to the Pacific coast, and that the distraction, all the illusion of democracy, wasn't really ensuring democracy. They were undermining it, and certainly they were undermining it when they refused to even debate slavery in Congress.
And in general, they both felt that partisan activity undermined critical thinking.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's why the celebrity factor in democracy irritated both of the Adamses. They were unique in that they were both incapable of promising anything or or doing a thing merely to catch the popular wave. They disliked partisan politics. They saw it leading to indoctrination of party members. Parties were referred to back then as factions. And so, you know, this gives us a really interesting backward look that speaks to the present moment. And, you know, people are pulling their hair out these days. The ironies of history are endless, and if we understand them better, we can understand better what it is that we face, you know, day to day, in the press, in the popular press, in the ever-present media. And you know, you started this interview by referring to their optimism. So there's what I think you get out of our book is that someone like Jefferson, well, they're all complicated, but Jefferson had this optimistic outlook about the potential of ordinary people to make informed choices. The Adamses didn't think that America was already, as Jefferson put it, the world's best hope. They thought that you needed to fortify the balance in government, that institutions had to rise to the occasion to be effective. They were problem solvers, and that was their message. If they had a message to us, to posterity, it was just that, you know?
Well, of their time and ahead of it, too. I mean,
yeah.
Well, I have to say that as wise and scholarly as this book is, it reads as though you had a lot of fun writing it.
Thank you. We sure did.
I can just imagine those dinner table conversations.
Well, we actually go for long walks.
Oh, okay.
That's when we debate and discuss what we're working on, what we're writing. And yes, I mean, they are fascinating people, and we don't sugarcoat them. We don't paint people to be put on idols, because this is the kind of history people need to see. You have to see people, you know, with the mistakes they made, as well as, you know, John Adams at times could be seen as being vain. His son was often portrayed as being a cold fish. So they're not perfect, but in a sense, that's more realistic. This is what real people are like. And I think we've learned a more important and a more complex way of looking at politics when we take in both the highs and the lows.
Right. And for readers, they are very good company. We've been talking with LSU professors Nancy Eisenberg and Andrew Burstein about their fascinating new book, The Problem of Democracy, The President's Adams Confront the Cult of Personality. Nancy, Andy, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Thank
you very
much.
We enjoyed speaking to you.
Here's the book song for your summer listening pleasure. Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side takes its title from the 1956 novel Walk on the Wild Side by Nelson Algren. It's the story of a Texan named Dove Linkhorn who drifts to New Orleans, although Lou Reed used characters from Andy Warhol's Factory in the song. Some of the novel's most memorable passages are Algren's three rules of life: never play cards with a man called Doc, never eat at a place called Mom's, and never sleep with a woman whose troubles are worse than your own. The version you're about to hear is from New Orleans' own A.J. Loria.
She, they said, hey, baby, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, sugar, take a walk on the wild side. And she did, she did, she did. Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the street, looking for soul food and a place to eat. You went to the Apollo and you should have seen them go, go, go. They said, hey, baby, take a walk on the wild side. All right, they said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. All right.
came from my hold on the island. In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost her hair, though, even when she was dipping. They said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, sugar, take a walk on the wild side.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Lacey Johnson signs her essay collection, The Reckonings, Tuesday, June 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Mary Beth Lima discusses and signs her book, Adventures of a Louisiana Birder, 1 year, 2 wings, 300 species, Wednesday, June 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Jane Trowbridge Bertrand discusses and signs You Started What After 60? High Pointing Across America, Wednesday, June 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kim Vodica and Lizzie Wan are the featured readers at Bloodjet Poetry Series, Wednesday, June 5th at 7:30 at The Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. Don't forget to check out the National World War II Museum's website for the event scheduled for the 75th anniversary of D-Day, a day-long celebration of discussions, films, and festivities. It's nationalww2museum.org. Martin Walker signs The Body in the Well, a Bruno Chief of Police novel, Thursday, June 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Earl Higgins discusses and signs 100 Catholic Things to Do Before You Die, Thursday, June 6th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Empire Star by Samuel R. Delaney, Saturday, June 8th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Bar Redux at 801 Poland presents Writer's Gumbo, a celebration and sharing of words, hosted by James Germain, with featured writers Jonathan Penton, Brianna Augustus, Joaquin Emiliano, Kathleen Conlon, Christopher Heffernan, Nicole Iden, Russell Mercado, and others. That's Sunday, June 9th at 8, again at 801 Poland. And coming up, Bloomsday returns Sunday, June 16th at 11 a.m. at various venues around town. This annual reading of James Joyce's Ulysses is looking for those who like to read aloud and like to listen. Check out the Facebook page, Bloomsday New Orleans 2019, for more information. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.